Boy, are we in a fight. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. There's a spiritual realm where people are fighting it out, or things are fighting it out for our souls. Entities are fighting it out for our souls. The devil and his minions, God and his angels. Those angels work on behalf of those who will inherit salvation, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14. And then you have the spiritual hosts of wickedness on the other side. And we're in this battle, and it doesn't take a lot of observation to tell. Can you turn on the news? We're in a worldview battle, aren't we? We're in a worldview battle where some people who have grown up at least with what William Barr called the vapor trails of Christianity. Did you catch that? The vapor trails of Christianity. That is, your great-grandparents might have been good Christians, and maybe their kids were nominal Christians, and maybe their kids aren't Christians at all, but at least they have the principles from a Christian worldview. Do you know that I read somewhere recently that to tell somebody to be nice and to tell somebody to work hard might be racist? Because I think it's the devil behind us trying to push a worldview against one another. And there are people out there that do not have a worldview that even acknowledges the golden rule. We are in a worldview battle, and it takes place in the political world, and it takes place in your personal world. It takes place when poor kids have to grow up in broken homes and not know if it was their fault or not. It wasn't their fault, but they kind of feel like that sometimes. It takes place in a world where husband cheats on his wife and a wife cheats on her husband, and all kinds of pain just ripples throughout their little community. We're in this fight for our souls, and it causes a lot of pain because we're in this fallen, sinful world. And what are we going to do about this fight for our souls? Well, I would like to invite you to go with me on a timeline, if you would. People in West Virginia mock me for doing a timeline, but that's okay. That's what we do in West Virginia, is mock each other. So what I'd like to tell you is, here's a timeline. Before this wall over here, on the other side of that wall, is before the foundation of the world. That's when God planned for Christ to come and save our souls. You realize that, right? He was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 20. So on the other side of that wall is the foundation of the, this is the foundation of the world, and on the other side of that is eternity. And how far into eternity is kind of a silly question, isn't it? You can't go, there's no time in eternity. So how far back, we don't know. But God planned for us to be here and then to send His Son when He knew we'd sin, we knew we'd fall away, and He wanted to send His Son at somewhere, oh, let's put that around here about the time that Christ would come, and out there somewhere, it could be right here, the end of time, or it could be out there somewhere, we don't know. But let's watch what God has done through history. I'm stealing an idea from one of my favorite preachers, David Farr. David Farr preached a lesson one time where he talked about God having crises in His plan of salvation. We're all about crises, aren't we? We've had a few crises in the last few years. Where is God when there is a crisis in His plan of salvation? What does He do? Well, let's see what He does. What do I mean by a crisis? Well, you see, God did not just send His Son to pop up in about what we know as AD 1 and say, hey, I'm a religious leader and follow me. That's how false religious leaders do it. Hey, I've had a dream, follow me. Hey, I've seen some golden plates, follow me. And they just pop out of nowhere. But no, God not only gave us 300 and some prophecies about Christ before He ever came, thousands of years before He ever came, hundreds of years before He ever came. Not only did God do that, He separated this whole nation. He called Abraham out, said, I'm going to make a new nation out of you. Go to a land where I'm going to tell you when you get there, and there's going to be a new nation come from you, and through your seed, you're going to have so much seed you can't count them, like the sand of the sea or the stars of the sky, and through your seed, all nations of the earth shall be blessed. And so then Abraham has Isaac, and Isaac has Jacob, and Jacob has those 12 sons, and those 12 sons have their kids, and they develop into this great nation of Israel, and then God narrows it down to prophesy that Christ would come from the tribe of Judah, one of Jacob's sons, and God narrows it down further in the time of David, about 1000 B.C., to say that the Christ, the Messiah, the one to bless all nations, the one to save people, is going to come through the lineage of David, and He narrows it down to a city of David called Bethlehem, through a virgin that he calls that he'd predicted way back then. God did all of that to say, here's my son. It's a little different than other religious leaders, wouldn't you say? But there were crises along the way. The first crisis, I suppose, was the worldwide flood. Now, if you get this principle in mind, God was having Christ come to die for the sins of the world. And you've read Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sins. Well, that was the old law, and that's what they offered because they felt so bad before the law, and then during the law, God told them that's what to do. But that could never completely work. So Hebrews 9:15 indicates that when Christ died, he died for those going forward. He died for those who had been faithful going backward. But what if the world had ended before Christ got here? What if a few generations before the flood, there had still been some righteous people, and then God said, the world's wicked, I'm going to wipe them out, and Christ never got here? Well, then those people would still be lost, wouldn't they? So there's a crisis. So God saves faithful Noah, his wife, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And through Shem come the Semitic people and the Jews. And the Jews, the Israelites, come so that Christ can bless all nations. Another crisis probably would have been when God saw that in the whole world in that area there was going to be a famine. And God spotted it in his omniscience about 20 years before it happened, the way I read the Bible. There's going to be a famine. And God thinks to himself, I suppose, this is not recorded this way, but bear with me for a minute. God thinks to himself, you know, I've got to do something about this. Now, God allows free will, and yet he knows the future. And I can't put those two together real well. Sometimes I think of it like this. On this plane, God knows the future. On this plane, he allows our free will, and he doesn't make us do what we do, but he can use what we do. Even sometimes if it's wrong. One of those 12 sons of Jacob was named Joseph. And he comes in tattling on his brothers one day. They don't like that too well. And Jacob kind of favors Joseph above the other sons. And that's not a good thing. And then Joseph's brothers hate him. That's awful. Genesis 37. And then they conspire to murder him. And that's not a good thing. And then, instead of murdering him, they sell him into slavery, and then they tell their father, or allow him to conclude that he's been killed by a wild beast. And then, did you ever notice this at the end of Genesis 37? The sons who allow their dad to conclude that Joseph's been killed by a wild beast try to comfort him. Oh, that sends chills up my spine. And yet, God used all that to get Joseph down into Egypt, where he met another sinful person named Potiphar's wife. I suppose that was her name. Potiphar's wife, who tried to seduce him and then falsely accused him of sexual harassment and then got him put in jail. And then somebody else forgets him. And then finally he gets out, and Pharaoh's having dreams about scarce cows eating full cows and scarce harvest bundles eating full harvest bundles and not being any different, and needs somebody to interpret the dreams. And Joseph has happened to interpret a couple of people's dreams in prison, the butler and the baker, and the butler's forgot about him for 2 years. And finally, Joseph stands before Pharaoh, and Joseph had to suffer all that. Joseph had to suffer all that, and then he stands before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, you know what, you're going to be in charge. Because you've predicted there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. You're going to be in charge of this thing to save the food and then provide for the famine. And then back in Canaan, 2 years into the famine, Joseph's brothers are hungry. And they have to come stand before him. No miracles except for maybe a planted dream. It's a budding nation of about 70 people, God's people. And he uses Joseph's suffering, all that free will evil, to get Joseph down into Egypt so that that family could move to the land of Goshen and be saved before they ever got wiped out. Do you suppose all that happened by accident? Joseph thought not. When those brothers finally stood before Joseph, you remember what he said to him in Genesis chapter 45, "But now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for it was not you who sent me here, but God. God sent me here to save your lives by a great deliverance, to prepare you a posterity, to save your posterity, some of the phrases that are used in Genesis 45, 5 through 7. Well, God had a crisis, and he solved it in his providence without a miracle. But then, those people are in Egypt for so long that they develop into a great nation of about 670,000 fighting men, add women and children, you got a couple million, and they're in slavery. A Pharaoh arose that did not know Joseph. He doesn't know what to do with them, so he says, kill all the baby boys. We don't want soldiers growing up. And that might just stop some of the offspring as well. Kill all the baby boys. But Moses' parents save him. Moses grows up to be 40, tries to do something. They reject him. He goes into the wilderness 40 years, and he comes back out when God calls him to lead the people of Israel up out of Egypt. But God says, I'm going to do it differently this time. This time there are going to be miracles. And I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. I know that gives us problems, but remember Romans chapter 9? What if God put up with a vessel of destruction for a long time and then used him for his good? God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and then he sends those 10 plagues. And we read those 10 plagues. I do them in my kids' class real quickly, like water to blood, frogs, lice, flies, cows got sick and died, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, death of the firstborn. You think 2020 was bad? Think about living through those things. And then the people finally get out, and they're coming to the Red Sea. And that's when God says to them through Moses, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians you see today, you shall see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. They'd been complaining. Now they're told, hold your peace. The Lord's going to fight for you. And then some more miracles ensue. You know about the parting of the Red Sea, but before that, you know about the pillar of cloud and fire that was light on the one side and dark on the other side to separate the Israelites from the Egyptians. And I love this little detail in chapter 14, 25 of Exodus. For the Egyptian army that was chasing after them, God took off their chariot wheels. Wouldn't that be something? Hey, I'm dragging along here. What's happened to my wheels? And that's what God did to them. And God saved them by a great deliverance because he was going to fight for his people. And then you fast forward a little bit and you come to other times. Well, wasn't too long. They got through the Red Sea. They said, the horse and his rider is thrown into the sea. God is a man of war. But then they said, we're not going to believe God. They complained about the manna. They complained about bread, so they got manna. They complained about water, so they got it from a rock. God is given the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, and they're worshiping a golden calf that Aaron said just sprung out when I melted this gold down. And then God says to them, go in and take this land. Now, you get more details about this in Deuteronomy chapter 1, where Moses is recounting it to him 40 years later. But God says, go in and take this land. But the people have a counter. In Numbers, it doesn't read this way, but in Deuteronomy, it does. The people say, well, how about we send in some spies? Moses says, okay, we'll send in some spies. And you know what happens? Those spies come back and say, oh, no, we can't go in there. Remember, God had already said, I'm giving you this land. Oh, no, we can't go in there. People are big, too much, too many. We can't fight them. But Moses said to him in Deuteronomy 1, 29 through 31, do not be terrified or afraid of them. For the Lord your God, who goes before you, don't you love that? He will fight for you. He will fight for you. He will fight for you, and he's going to deliver you. The Lord your God, he will fight for you as he did with the Egyptians, he mentions, and as in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son. Oh, isn't that tender? I've carried my son from the time he was like this to the time he was over my shoulder to the time he was on my back. Going up a hiking trail in the mountains of West Virginia, Seneca Rocks, Kathy. And then I quit when he got to be 6'2 and 250 pounds. Man carries his son. That's a tender image. But the people said, we're not going to go. For all that, you would not believe the Lord your God. That's a crisis. God fixed it by exercising his justice to punish that generation and then also then allowing the next generation to go in. Then you come to a real big crisis, but it's fast forwarding a long time. You could take your time on these things, but you're going from about here to about 1,000 years later, about the time that the people are in captivity, about 479 BC, somewhere right around there, if I understand correctly, where some of the people have come back from captivity in 536 BC, and some people have come back in, are going to come back just a little bit later, but right about then, some of the Jews are still out there, and there's Babylon that's been overtaken by Persia, and there's this wicked man that wants to destroy all the Jews. Now, what if he had destroyed all the Jews? We'd have never gotten to Christ, would we? So there's this wicked man that wants to destroy all the Jews because one of them won't bow down to him. Haman is puffed up in his pride, but Mordecai the Jew will not bow down to him. Well, it just so happens then, it just so happens, could you hear that phrase with some cynicism? It just so happens that a little before that, Queen Vashti had said, I'm not parading my beauty in front of your bunch of drunken men, you king. And so the king demotes her. The king gets lonely, as if he would, with all the harem that he probably had. But he gets lonely, so they go out looking for another queen. And they happen to find this Esther, whose parents have happened to die, and she has happened to been raised by Mordecai, the same guy that won't bow to Haman eventually. And then it so happens that Mordecai is in the right place at the right time to hear about Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who are plotting an assassination attempt on the king. He turns them in. It's written in the book of the Chronicles of the King. Those two people are executed. Nothing's done for Mordecai. But life goes on. He didn't want anything. And then that's when about Haman gets his plan. Mordecai won't bow down to me. What should I do? Well, let's just destroy all the Jews. Let's do that. So he gets the king's idea and he says to the king, we'd like to destroy all the Jews. They're just causing trouble for us in this area. So we ought to destroy all of them. And the king says, okay, whatever you want, you can do that. So they set a day on which they're going to destroy all the Jews. And then it just so happens that Mordecai hears about that. He cries out loudly. Esther, who's pretty much a captive queen, sends to find out why he's so sad. He tells her, and he says, you got to do something about this. You're the queen. She says, I can't do that. I may be the queen, but if you go into the king without being invited, you just can't do that because he'll kill you. It's death, unless he happens to be in a good mood and extends the royal scepter to you. And that's when Mordecai utters these chilling words. Do not think that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, watch this, relief and deliverance will arise from another place. How did he know that? How did he know relief and deliverance would come from another place if she remained silent? She's in the perfect condition to do it. That's why he says, the famous statement, and who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Maybe this is your spot. Maybe this is why God sent you here. Maybe that's why all these things happen to have happened. No miracles. God's name not even mentioned in the book. None of the miraculous. Not even a dream. All this stuff just happens to happen that she's in the right place at the right time to save the people of God so that the Christ can come. But if you don't do it, Esther, we'll get relief somewhere else, but you and your father's house will perish. How? Because God will fight for his people. He's always done it, and he always will. So, you know what happens then. She goes into the king. He sends the royal scepter. He says, what do you want up to half my kingdom? Well, I'd like just to serve you and Haman dinner tomorrow. Okay, that'd be great. So the next day, they have a great dinner, and he says, what do you want up to half my kingdom? Well, how about dinner tomorrow? That'd be good. One more banquet tomorrow. But Haman goes home, and he's just puffed up in his pride, but Mordecai won't bow down to him. He goes home and cries to his wife. His wife says, build a gallows on which to hang Mordecai, and go into the king in the morning and suggest that Mordecai be hanged on these 50-cubit-high gallows. Okay, that's a good idea, honey. That's what I'll do. So he goes to do that, but it just so happened that night, the king couldn't sleep. And he didn't watch Leno or Letterman, or anybody that's on nowadays since I quit watching TV 10 years ago. He had to have somebody come read to him. And they just happened to open in the Chronicles of the book to where Mordecai had saved his life. So he starts wonder what we've done to honor Mordecai. He kind of wonders out loud a little bit. And then he says, who's that standing out there? Oh, that's Haman. Haman, come in here. What should be done, hypothetically, for the man whom the king delights to honor? Well, Haman thinks it's him. Well, I think you should put him on a royal horse, and you should put a royal robe on him and the royal crown, and you should have somebody parade him around town and say, "Thus it shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor." Good, Haman. Go do that for Mordecai. So he has to do that, and he comes home crying, and he wonders what he's going to do, and his wife says, "You've had it if you're messing with Mordecai." And he did. The next day at the banquet, the king says, "What do you really want, Esther?" Esther says, "I want you to know that somebody has plotted to kill all my people." "Who is this?" "It's this wicked Haman." Now the king is so angry, he gets up and leaves the room, and Haman is so distraught, he's going pleading to Esther and apparently falls on top of her right when the king walks back in. "Are you going to assault my wife also?" And then a little guy steps out from back behind somewhere, Harbona the eunuch, and he says, "You know, king, there happens to be a gallows outside." "Oh, good, hang him on it." And then the people are saved because God will fight for his people. Now then, you come to the New Testament era. And I think you know a lot about Romans chapter 8 already. "For whom he foreknew, he called, and whom he called, he also justified, and whom he justified, he also glorified," Romans 8 verse 30. "And what then shall we say to these things?" Romans 8 verse 31. "If God is for us, who can be against us?" And then this verse. "If God did not spare his only son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things?" I've read that verse for a long time, and I thought, you know, that's pretty good. Here's Christ, who had to suffer the scourging, had to suffer the rejection of his people, had to suffer the crucifixion, had to suffer the rejection by his apostles, had to suffer their slowness for a long time, had to even come to earth in the first place. God, if God did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, then what are we worried about going forward? But then put it in this context. Not only all of that, but if God did not spare his own son by saving us 400 years before he came, by saving his people 1,000 years before he came, if God put all that work into fighting for his people, what do you think he's going to do now? He's going to fight for his people. And when we face all these hardships out there, you know, we may be like Joseph and have 13 years from 17 to 30 where we're going, why? And then you find out, oh, it's so that I could save my family. We may have a long time like that. Or we may have death. But if we're more than conquerors through him who loved us, because death ain't nothing anymore, is it? Where is your sting? Where is your power, O grave? Where are you, 1 Corinthians 15:55? There's nothing in death for the Christian. But we might have to suffer all that, but God will fight for us. And in this New Testament age, God has equipped his glorious church with the armor of God. It's not just a Bible lesson. It's a powerful truth that you're girded with the waist belt of truth, and you have the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit and the shield of faith and the breastplate of righteousness. You got everything you need to go out and fight a battle. And God has allowed the persecuted church to be comforted by knowing that he has delivered us. He will deliver us. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10. We know that God will deliver us, Paul said. We had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should learn not to trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he will still deliver us. God has given the persecuted church the comfort of knowing that you're going to have some strength that comes from it. You're going to grow from it. But even if you die from it, God will be with you. And God has given a loving church so that we can bear each other's burdens, Galatians chapter 6, verse 2. And the Father of mercies and God of all comfort has given us each other so we can pass on that comfort to each other in tribulation, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. And God has given the purchased church confidence. If you ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And we know that if he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we shall have the things that we have asked of him. I'm not going to ask him for a new car. I'm not going to ask him for a new house. That might not be his will. It's not a matter of getting his will in line with mine. It's a matter of getting my will in line with his and then asking him for those things. And he's promised. And God has given the pure church, designed before the foundation of the world to be holy and without blame before him in love, the tools to equip ourselves from fighting within ourselves because all of our sin and all of our trouble. Did you ever notice that all drama comes from sin? You ever watch a TV drama? Is there any sin in it? I mean, it might not be that you're looking at something you shouldn't be looking at, but there's sin that causes some of the drama. And it used to just be on TV, but now it's here in real life, at least in my circumstance. People around me. God's given us the power to stop lusting and stop fighting amongst ourselves and stop looking after our own pleasures. He's given us the power to do that because He's always promised and He always will fight for us. Now, when we fight, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God through pulling down strongholds. Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of Christ. Did you catch that? We're in a philosophical battle. Are we going to follow a Christian worldview? Are we going to follow a pagan or atheistic worldview? And the battle is not with fighting each other, and the battle is not punching each other, and the battle is not being mean to each other on social media. Trap into which I've fallen sometimes. The battle is what makes sense. Who's right? You bring every thought into captivity to Christ. And we have the ability and the weapons in the Bible to do that. God will fight for you as a father carries his son. Now, I gave you an illustration about a father carrying his son physically. Can I give you an illustration about a father carrying his son spiritually? When I graduated high school back in 1900, none of your business, I had planned a 3-day trip with my friends to Cedar Point up on Lake Erie. A few weeks before we went, my friends piped up and said, "How much beer are we going to take?" Now, I had not always been the best person, but I had repented by that time. And I wondered what to do about this. I was a kid. I was 17. And I was talking to Dad about it. What do I do about this? My dad said to me this: "If you want to tell them, I won't let you go, you can do that." Is there a more tender thing to say? You see what he's doing? He's willing to stand up for me, but he's hoping I'll do it for myself. And God was willing to stand up for Israel, but sometimes they had to do some obeying themselves, like going into the land of Canaan. And we're not supposed to despise the chastening of a father. We're not supposed to despise that because it makes us better people, and therefore we're not supposed to despise the chastening of our Father in heaven. If you want to tell them, I won't let you go, you can do that. Well, I finally manned up for once in my life and said, "Guys, I ain't going," and didn't involve my dad in it. Here's a father carrying his son. I was blessed to have a good father like that, and a lot of people aren't. But when you think of the Father in heaven who's willing to fight for his people, who's willing to do whatever it takes to get the Christ to them, to save their souls, to save the sins, save people from the sins, save those people who've been faithful throughout all the ages. When you think of a father that's willing to fight and give us all these tools in the New Testament era, let's not think God is dead, all right? Let's not press ahead with our worries, our fears, and think God's doing nothing now because he's not doing miracles. Do you know one time a fella said to me, "Andy, you are limiting the power of God because you deny modern day miracles." And I wish I had said to him, but I'm not this quick, I wish I had said to him, "No, sir, you're denying the power of God if you say he has to have miracles to work. He can work through his providence, and he will work through his providence." And boy, in times like this, this is what keeps me going. How about you? I thank you for your attention tonight and hope that it's been helpful. I'm awfully grateful to be here.